Good evening. I'm going to be speaking this evening, and as I am, I simply want to welcome people. If you have questions, to take yourself off mute and raise a hand or anything like that. So that we can make this somewhat interactive. It's great to see all of you. So I'm going to be speaking a bit tonight about, I'm going to start by talking about working with the senses, and we'll go on from there. So the senses, we all have those in Buddhism. We get the six senses, right? The five physical senses and then the mind. And, if you see a good movie, you can get totally enwrapped in it, or reading a good book, you get totally engrossed in it and taken away to another world, right? And that's really kind of, to some extent, what we look for in entertainment. We want something that's going to take us away. If something is not entertaining, we go to a movie that's not entertaining, or a book that's not entertaining, it ends up sitting on the nightstand for a while, or on the end table. And this is really no different from other parts of life, right? We like this stimulation, right? And in one sense, totally fine. There's no problem with that at all. However, it's easy to get caught in the show. Whether we're looking for the game to play, or a new note, there's a new notification on your phone or your iPad, you get an iMessage, or somebody's FaceTiming you, whatever it is, you want something to eat or a good conversation with a friend, whatever. We're always taking in this stimulation through the senses, and we like it, right? So there's this, I'm gonna quote from a couple discourses this evening from the Samyutta Nikaya. The first one is titled The All. I'll read you the whole thing. It's two paragraphs, so it's going to be easy, nice and brief. Monastics, I will teach you the All. Listen. And what, monastics, is the All? The eye and sights, the ear and sounds, the nose and smells, the tongue and tastes, the body and sensations, the mind and mental phenomena. This is called the All. If anyone, monastics, should speak thus, having rejected this All, I shall make known another All, that would be a mere empty boast on their part. If they were questioned, they would not be able to reply, and further, they would meet with vexation. Common thing in the discourses. If a topic is just too much, it leads to vexation. Well, for what reason? Because monastics, they would not be within their domain. They would not be within their kind of range of what they know. They would be talking out of school. So they would not know what they were talking about if they were doing that. So the Buddha is saying that when it comes to taking in information, everything that we get comes through these six channels. That's it. That's all we get, right? These are gates through which we take in and create our whole world. If we lost one of the senses, or didn't have them, if I had completely had lost my hearing, then I would still then I'd still just have the remaining ones and that kind of thing. And I think it's interesting. We use the senses a lot in meditation, right? We may start by opening to hearing and sensing the body, and then sensing the breath. And we can be with the other senses as well. Say in a retreat setting, most commonly, we can be with taste and that kind of thing. And yet, I still feel they go kind of unquestioned on some level. I think we often get caught in the object that comes in through the sense and not the sense itself, and don't see how there's this kind of process happening here. And, you know, we create, as the Buddha said, we create the all, we create our whole worlds with these. This is the first of the five aggregates form, these senses. So the sense experiences, they're real in the extent that they are happening, right? We are having these experiences that are arising. And yet what happens is that they don't kind of unquestioningly, because of the way this stuff is coming in so quickly and it's all being put together and that kind of thing, we use them to kind of compose this reality, to put together, to compose, to fabricate this reality that becomes then unquestioned. Yeah, so I think it can be helpful to start to see them more clearly and to see how we are making this world. How there's some way in which we take these things and create this experience, piece them together. So how do we learn to relate to them more skillfully? First, we have to be able to see what's happening. So we, you know, over time, first we get to know the senses a little bit. We start to get exposed to them. And then, you know, we start to practice with them in meditation using one sense or another, and we start to notice that. And over time, we start to see that a little more clearly as to what's happening. I'm going to read excerpts of another discourse from the Samyutta Nikaya, the simile of the six animals. And the Buddha is talking to the monastics about understanding restraint and non-restraint. And how, bhikkhus, is there non-restraint? Suppose, bhikkhus or monastics, a person would catch six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds and tie them by a strong rope. They would catch a snake, a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a jackal, and a monkey, and tie each by a strong rope. Having done so, they would tie the ropes together with a knot in the middle and release them. Now, I'm not talking about actually tying animals together, but as a simile, I think it's useful. Then those six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds would each pull in the direction of its own feeding ground and domain. The snake would pull one way, thinking, "Let me enter an anthill." The crocodile would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter the water." The bird would pull another way, thinking, "Let me fly up into the sky." The dog would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter a village." The jackal would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter a charnel ground." The monkey would pull another way, thinking, "Now let me enter a forest." Now, when these six animals become worn out and fatigued, they would be dominated by the one among them that was strongest. They would submit to it and come under its control. It is in such a way, monastics, that there is non-restraint. Okay. And how, monastics, is there restraint? Suppose, monastics, a man would catch six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds and tie them by a strong rope. You get where this is going, right? Okay, the six animals, the snake, crocodile, bird, dog, jackal, and monkey. Having done so, they would bind them to a strong post or pillar. Then those six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds would each pull in the direction of its own feeding ground and domain. The snake would pull one way, thinking, "Let me enter an anthill," and so on and so forth. The monkey would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter a forest." Now, when these six animals become worn out and fatigued, they would stand close to that poster pillar. They would sit down there. They would lie down there. Okay. It is in such a way that there is restraint. So too, monastics, when a monastic has developed and cultivated mindfulness directed to the body, the eye does not pull in the direction of agreeable forms, nor are disagreeable forms repulsive. The ear does not pull in the direction of agreeable sounds, nor are disagreeable sounds repulsive. The nose does not pull in the direction of agreeable odors, nor are disagreeable odors repulsive. And so on, and so on. The mind does not pull in the direction of agreeable mental phenomena, nor are disagreeable mental phenomena repulsive. It is in such a way that there is restraint. A strong post or pillar, this, monastics, is a designation for mindfulness directed to the body. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We'll develop and cultivate mindfulness to the body. Make it our vehicle. Make it our basis. Stabilize it. Exercise ourselves in it and fully perfect it. Thus, you should train yourselves. Okay. So, the first time I heard that discourse, that really struck me, that simile of the animals and them. They pull according to their nature, according to their domain, wherever it is that they live and however it is that they know about how they act and interact with the world. That's how they do it. In the same way, without that pillar, without that post of mindfulness, and in particular, he's calling this mindfulness of the body, right? Senses arise in the body. Yeah. Without this post or pillar, with this post or pillar, there is some stability. And over time, these six untamed animals gain some, they start to settle, right? I think this is just a pretty accurate description of how the untrained mind relates to the senses. We scan for something pleasant or unpleasant. We, you know, mind likes candy and we'll take unpleasant at times. The ego wants something to entertain it, right? We like something. Depending on personality, you know, we've got the different personality types. The greed types, pleasant may be the first choice or the first thing that they notice. And the aversive types, it may be the unpleasant is the first thing they notice. And the deluded types may be lost more in delusion. But we will, even as an aversive type, I'll go towards the greed type, something really pleasant, rather. I'll go towards something really pleasant if it's available there. I'll take that. Mary, did you have a question? Mary Page, were you? No, okay. Yeah, so for all the personality types, in other words, for all of us, the mind will gladly go looking for something to entertain it, right? Those animals that are not connected to that post or pillar. And, yeah. But this discourse is saying that we can develop restraint through how we relate to the sense experience. If we use mindfulness. We use mindfulness to know our experience, and over time, and we see this in the course of a single meditation period, we may see the mind start to settle. And then we also more longitudinally over longer periods of time, over the years and decades of practice, we will see that the mind is settling over time. And what settles is not the outer experience. It's not the experience out there. It's not that sights stop arising. Well, you know, if we lose sight, that may happen, or the vision may get dimmed with age. But, you know, really the sounds and the sights and the smells and the tastes and the sensations in the body and the mental phenomena, those continue to come. We all still continue to get those. So what settles is not that outer experience. It's our internal relationship to it. So how do we nurture this relationship of that settling of the mind and body? And so that mindfulness can start to create some spaciousness around experience. And we can use mindfulness to see, to really frame some of these characteristics that the Buddha spoke about, so that we can see experience as it arises, as it persists, and as it passes away, right? We can see the unsatisfactory nature of these wants. And we can see certainly see over time, the impersonal nature of things. And this is not, I don't want to give the impression that pleasant experiences are bad or not good in some way. Even the external, or what I believe the Buddha was referring to as the worldly pleasant experiences, are fine. These are part of the experience. I can remember when I was in Burma, one evening, the sunset was particularly beautiful, and there tended to be a decent amount of interaction amongst the monastics. And I can't remember who all I was with. There was at least one other monk there. And then I tried to get another monk to join us, not try to get him to break his silence at all, but he was interacting a little bit with some others and tried to get him to join us. And he came over, and I was like, oh, we're just looking at the sunset. You see how beautiful it is. He said that no, he didn't want to look because the abbot had said to avoid attachment. I was just crushed. I don't think that's a skillful use of that avoiding that. Now, there can also be unskillfulness in terms of looking at that sunset and trying to grab it and coming up with this whole story around it. I remember this sunset is as pretty as that time I was with my cousin Dave. Remember that? Oh yeah, we were on that river tree, you know, going off and creating this story, creating my own world there. But so in other words, this is not to say that pleasant experience should be, is bad or harmful in some way. And as a matter of fact, the unworldly pleasant experience, at least as I understand it, the unworldly pleasant experience being the pleasant that arises from wholesome mind states and in meditation and things like that. Those are, you know, bring that on. It's so important in the path of development. So mindfulness, it's that receptive, has that receptiveness to it, that opening to experience, and really knowing the experience fully. It can also see the associations with the object, like with that example of me talking about the sunset. If I'm coming up with that story, mindfulness can actually hold that whole story and how the mind is going off and creating this world, right? There's a difference between that and if I'm getting lost in the story, right? But mindfulness can hold that. Mindfulness is not perturbed by anything. Hatred, mindfulness can know hatred. Judging, comparing, and fixing. We can use mindfulness to know judging, comparing, and fixing, which is important because if we can't know it with mindfulness, how will we ever learn to work with it skillfully? We can notice the pleasantness and unpleasantness of an experience, or the neither pleasant nor unpleasantness of it. We can notice the qualities of the heart-mind that come about based on experience. We can also see the conditional nature of experience, start to see that. What causes something to arise? What causes it to persist? What causes it to pass away? So mindfulness can be very powerful. And I think all of you have done a lot of development. All of you that I know, which is a good number of you, have done a lot of development with mindfulness. And once mindfulness is kind of one level of knowing an experience. There's that initial level of just kind of consciousness, that kind of base level of the experience arising and being known. That has to happen in order for mindfulness to know the experience, right? A person, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out the sequencing here. Okay. So what I also want to talk about is there's another level, is that we can know that knowing of experience. Okay. And we can start to do this. A good way to do this is through the senses. We can start to see that there is, okay, so we have these. Okay, I'm going to jump ahead because I think I got my sequencing. I think this makes sense first. In order for something to arise in awareness, what's called contact in Buddhism, what the Buddha called contact, there have to be three things. There has to be a sense object, there has to be a sense organ, and there has to be sense consciousness. Okay, so what is that? So, for example, for right now, I can see you all because I see this computer screen in front of me. You're seeing your computer screens or your iPad screens. I can also see a card sitting here on my desk, right? So that card is there. There has to be that card, and there has to be the eyes, and then there has to be eye consciousness in order for me to see that. Right. In order for you to hear my voice, there has to be an object, the sound of my voice. There has to be, you have to have hearing that functions either on its own, with hearing aids, whatever. And there has to be ear consciousness. And I actually think this is quite useful because we can start to see these things, see some of the separateness there. So we can start to look at the knowing that arises, that consciousness there. For example, you're hearing my voice. So there's the sound of my voice that's arising. And then there's the knowing of it. If you think about it, if there weren't the knowing of it, you wouldn't hear it. Right? Any nods to that? Yeah, okay, some nods. All right. So just noticing, hearing is being known, and we can start to notice that. And so in my experience, the knowing does not separate from the object. Knowing has to be there in order for the object to be known, but it is kind of a separate, it's not totally separate, but it is, it's a, there's something distinct there, if that makes sense. So we can start to pay attention to that. Actually, in a day long with Maren Sangha a couple of years ago, Philip talked about this as the capacity of knowing, right? He talked about knowing as a capacity. It's not going to come apart from the hearing so much, but because the knowing is, the sense consciousness is known through these objects, with it, it connects to these objects and helps them to be known. Okay, so what's useful about this? Why? What's the big deal? So in my experience, it can really help us to see through the three characteristics more. It helps us, it certainly can make things less personal. There's more space around experience as it's coming in. And the mind can be less reactive. It can be more responsive because we're taking it less personally. We're seeing the impersonal nature of it. And it can also allow the mind to become more steady, right? If we go like with, sometimes on in meditation, we go to choiceless awareness, and the mind is not steady enough. So it jumps a little bit and then we're off and we're tumbling in this story about the hike that we took and that dog that we saw and why didn't the person have the dog on the leash? And there should be a leash law on all trail, you know, we're off to the races then. So it can aid, in my experience, in helping the mind to become more steady, because that consciousness is more steady in that way. The breath changing all the time. Sometimes people cannot stay with the breath. It's not a useful object for them because it's changing too much. There's no kind of place that they can anchor, latch onto or something. Well, that knowing is quite steady, you know, much more kind of continuous there in that way. Hearing, that may change too much. Well, the knowing of breath or the knowing of hearing is much more steady. Dukkha, the first noble truth, the unsatisfactory nature of experience. Linda, do you have a question? Yes, please.
So in your analogy with sound, I may be engrossed in reading a book and a sound occurs. My ear didn't stop hearing it, yet I did not register the sound because I was engrossed in this book. So is that what you're talking about, the sense conscious?
Yeah. So we have the sense consciousness would be when you're reading the book, there is seeing and there's...
Right.
So there's the consciousness of seeing. And then there's probably with something like a book, there's a lot of mental stuff in there.
Right.
Right. So we're seeing that. We're doing that. In my experience, it's easier to start to know this knowing with things like hearing and sensing in the body. And we'll do an exercise in a little bit. You have a follow-up question? Go right ahead.
Yeah. So what I was saying is like I'm reading, but a sound occurs. I didn't stop hearing this sound. My ears didn't stop working. Yet I just did not register that right. sound. So is that what you're talking about? The sense consciousness is the recognition of that sound?
Yes. And it would have to be, there are times when we get so engrossed in some activity that right. that a sense won't distract us, right?
Right?
We're doing something and somebody says, hey, Linda, and no, you're so focused on something, right?
Right.
And I've heard people say that in the jhanas, in these states of kind of where the mind is just so gathered and collected, it's really unified around the object and that people you don't hear things.
Right.
You don't hear things, you don't feel things, that kind of thing. What I'm talking about more is the actual, as opposed to being with the sense object, we tend to take like this computer screen or these sights that we see or these sounds that we hear. And what I'm pointing to is that an alternative is to be with the knowing of them as opposed to kind of the object itself.
I'll let you continue.
Okay. Dukkha is the unsatisfactory nature of experience. On a retreat that I did with Venerable Analeo, who I know some of you are big fans of, I really find him to be a wonderful practitioner and scholar. And quite a wonderful blend of those. But somebody asked him about what the best translation was for dukkha. And he doesn't like to translate it. He just feels like the word has too much kind of nuance to it. Somebody was saying, is it suffering? And he picks up his water glass, and he says, this glass is dukkha, but it's not suffering. This glass cannot provide any lasting satisfaction, right? This kind of goes to the Ajahn Chah thing of seeing, you know, the cup is already broken, you know, that kind of thing. It's not going to be, it has no permanence to it. And it can't be, he can't ultimately actually possess it. We can't ultimately possess things, right? So in that way, it is dukkha. And there's dukkha, we all get dukkha, right? There's that physical or emotional pain. There's the dukkha of the changing nature of things, right? We get everything in our lives kind of lined up. You know, I've had that experience in my life where it's like, things in my life are going well. It feels like, oh, I did it, man. Look at me, I got it. Uh-oh. One of the wheels comes off, right? Because that's the nature of life. That is how life works. And then there's also the dukkha of how things are put together or composed, the compositional nature of experience. When we can rest in the knowing, we do a lot less of creating this extra dukkha, this kind of added on stuff that we get by craving, right? Through that thirst, that tanha. We spend less energy trying to make things happen. And not perfectly. It's not a panacea. It's not going to fix everything. This is not enlightenment and two easy steps or anything like that. But it does help us to see, to start to see our experience in ways that are less personal, where we get caught, we can get caught less. And that's what I think is useful. So we're gonna do a little, okay, if we do a little guided meditation, can I just see a thumbs up? Yeah, okay, all right. We're gonna do a little guided meditation. Probably no more than like 3 to 5 minutes, and then I'll be happy to open it up to, I'll say maybe a little bit more, and then we'll open it up to questions. And we can start with the eyes closed, but I am gonna ask you to open your eyes at some point during the meditation, and I'll tell you when. And that's an important part of the meditation. You know, sometimes in our community, we like to keep the eyes closed because that's how we know about how to meditate. And there's going to be a time when I'm going to want you to open your eyes. So just noticing sound coming in. There are a couple different ways that you can, a couple different notes that you can make. Actually, I don't think that teachers are using noting much these days, but you can do that anyway. There may be sounds in your room, the sound of my voice. I'll ring the bell different times. But just notice that hearing is being known. You can just make that note to yourself. Hearing is being known. Sounds can be. Hearing is being known. Another note that you could make is there's the hearing and the knowing of it. that knowing doesn't come apart. It's just right here. It has to be right here, or you wouldn't be hearing it. Hearing is being known. As you hear the sound of my voice, sounds in your room, and then the body, you can either open to the body as a whole, or some part of the body. Just sensing some part of the body. Sensing is being known. There's the sensing and the knowing of it. Turning to the breathing. Breathing is being known. Wherever you're noticing the breathing, this is true. There's the breathing and the knowing of it. And it can know pleasant experiences and unpleasant experiences. There's the hearing and the knowing of it. And then opening the eyes softly. You can look at your screen, look around your apartment, your house, the room that you're in. Seeing is often a harder sense to do this with for many people, but not always. Seeing is being known. Seeing the book is being known. There's the seeing and the knowing of it. So when we stay more with the knowing, I guess my experience with it is more of there's a bit more spaciousness, experience is a bit less personal. We're not using it to keep experience at bay or as some kind of bypass or a way to avoid difficult things. It's actually, we go through the experience. We're with the experience fully. Yeah. So questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah, it's very strange because I do sense a really strong, different energetic with knowing rather than just seeing or not knowing. And part of it, I almost feel like there's an intention. And it almost feels like I more energy is collected when I'm knowing something than when knowing is happening than when just say, seeing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of that pole with the animals, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's the pole.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I can lose spaciousness because I'm knowing.
Yes, we do. We do lose it. We do get lost over and over. Yeah. Mary? Yeah.
One of the things I know about myself is I tend to scream. And I think everybody does to a certain degree. And so...
You tend to scream?
Scream things out, yeah. And I mean, I work with people who had especially autistic, all the information comes in at once. And there's just so much, you know, sound, sight, smell, and it's overpowering. I screen stuff out. And I mean, I know I do this because, you know, it's, you know, what you're looking at, what you're paying attention to and that kind of thing. What I have found though, is that like somebody will say, oh, can't you hear that sound? How annoying it is. And I actually don't hear it, but then I actually drop into my body. And I actually feel like I'm dropping into the sense gate of hearing. And when it's a very different kind of thing. I'm not reaching out to hear things, but I'm just dropping in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this very spacious receptor
mm-hmm.
where I'm knowing that I'm hearing things. And no matter what the sound is, it's just hearing. It's not like it's going to be, unless it was damaging my eardrums, it's not unpleasant. It's just the sound. And I found that for hearing, especially, that's something where when I could know it, I have that kind of that sense of knowing, and I'm much able to hold all of it. Some of my other sense gates don't work so well that way, you know. Just you know, but
yeah.
but I do know that I do know. It's like, you know, I just remember walking with my husband, and we were walking the same place, and I'm noticing the flowers and how lovely they are, and he's looking at the porch that needs to be fixed.
Right.
You know,
okay.
So we do this, but when you want to just drop into the knowing of it, like, you know, seeing and just let it, like when we were doing that before, it's just, it was very spacious and
yeah.
stuff. And it was like, there was no priorities. I don't know how to explain it better.
Yeah. No,
it was kind of interesting to see. And I think as an artist, when you're drawing and looking at things, you actually have to use that of just actually seeing is seeing without the other stuff going on.
Great.
So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, in my experience, hearing is probably the easiest sense to do this with. You could also sometimes often with the breath. I can remember Philip used to say in his guided meditations all the time, there's the breath and the knowing of it. I'm like, what is he talking about? What is he talking about? It's like, oh, there's that knowing there. It's right. It's you can't separate it from the breath, right? You can't separate it from the sounds. It's just right there. You can open to it. And just working with this practice over a period of time can help if you have any interest in this. Yes, Shaya. Shaya, you're still on mute, I think. Let's see I asked to unmute. How do I do that? Bill, can you unmute Shaya? Oh, there we go. Okay.
Well, going back to Linda's question, if you don't know that you're hearing, so there's the sound that she was referring to, and she didn't hear it because she was so involved with her book. So it's sort of like the parable of, well, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, is there a sound? So, you know, there are all kinds of phenomena that are happening in our environment all the time, and we don't acknowledge them, we don't register them. So, you know, sometimes there's the hearing, but there's not the knowing. I know that's not the way you're using the term, but there is sound and you don't hear it.
Yeah, that happens. That certainly happens.
It happens a lot. I mean, there's a lot of sounds in the world.
Yeah, I think to kind of like what Mary was saying, Mary Kelly was saying about how we see certain things and not others, you know. I suppose, you know. So we miss a lot of stuff, and you know, we could go into it would be a different talk, but we could certainly it's certainly valuable to look think about, you know, do you see what you believe or believe what you see, kind of thing. So. Anybody else? Linda, you wanna, do you still have more questions about this or? No? Okay. So if you want to work with this, then I would recommend make it a part of your daily practice. You could do it for 5 minutes. Breathing is being known, or just do hearing. Hearing is being known. One of those two would be great, and you can do that. And over a period, I don't think it will necessarily take super long to get some sense of that. Yeah? That's all we're looking for, is some sense of that. Yeah. And then we can use that as a way to create more spaciousness in our more spaciousness and therefore more responsiveness in our day-to-day lives. The world can certainly use more responsiveness right now. You know, you could turn that responsiveness towards any one of the many problems that our world is facing, that our country is facing right now. So those are all possibilities there. Opportunities.